Our last case of this morning is number 04-2608, Dean against the Chicago Transit Authority. Mr. Andry.
May it please the court, counsel. Now, this case involves a situation where summary judgment motion was filed. We were to be given time to respond to that summary judgment motion. During the period that we were to respond to the summary judgment motion, a motion was filed to amend the summary judgment motion. And by the time that motion was granted, there were 6 days left in our time to respond to the summary judgment motion. We did not object to the motion to amend, and we did not object to a number of motions, including the motion originally to extend the time to file a summary judgment motion. The practice in the district court in the 30 years that I've been practicing is normally when you do not contest a motion, you do not appear simply to waste time. I've even had this morning, for example, I appeared on a motion to amend a motion made by my opponent before Judge Anderson. I was 5 minutes late because of the line coming in. I came in, Judge Anderson stopped what he's doing with another case and just simply issued to me, "Mr. Andry, you didn't need to appear. The case has already been, the motion has been granted, and you've been given till January 7th to respond." That's the customary fashion of things. In fact, to do otherwise, because this is a potential cost-shifting case, and because it could cost my client, wouldn't make a lot of sense, because I'm costing additional time and money by coming to court simply to say I don't object to something. We then filed within 20 days of the decision about the amendment of
counsel,
the...
Counsel, are you assuming that the judge can rule on his own without your appearance that you don't object, unless you haven't even filed anything?
Sure. In fact, that's exactly what happened this very morning. I walked into court 5 minutes.
One judge may be more careless.
Well, that's true. But, you know, I've been in practice here for 30 years now. I have never...
You're 20 years shy of me.
I'm sorry?
You're 20 years shy of me.
And that's why I'm more ignorant than you are.
No, I don't see you.
But the point of it all is simply to make this point. The protocol is that when you don't object to a motion in the district court, at least in the Northern District of Illinois, when you don't object, you don't come in just to say, "I don't object."
You could file a paper, though.
Yes, and I did. In fact,
saying that I don't object to this being granted, you filed it with the court?
You could, but no, I've never done that. I've never had a judge require me to do that. Normally, the attorneys communicate with each other. I had been in communication with Mr. Thomas, who was the attorney at the time, and he knew I had no objection to it or anything.
He advised the court that you had no...
I don't know what he advised the court. I wasn't there.
Unless he had the authority, he wouldn't.
Well, he may have. I just honestly don't know what he advised the court in my absence. But the point is that we filed a response to the summary judgment motion within 20 days. We indicated in our response our preoccupation with various other things, including some matters before the Seventh Circuit. And what we then asked the judge is to simply allow us to file in stanter our response. It was already prepared. The response to the Rule 56 statement was prepared, the memorandum of law, everything. So we weren't simply going in late to ask for more time to file something. We were going in admittedly late, but we were saying, let us file this, what we have before you. There was no prejudice that would have been suffered whatsoever to the defendant by allowing us to proceed with more than just simply 6 days after their amendment had been allowed. In fact, we did it within 20 days. So we feel that there was an abuse of discretion by the judge in not permitting us to file that in stanter. In addition, even if that response is not even allowed, and you look at the fact statement submitted, the 56 statement submitted by the defendants, summary judgment is not appropriate here. They admitted, for example, that we had, when taking a deposition of the plaintiff, indicated that my client in an age discrimination case had been told, quote, "We don't want old guys like you here." And with regard to the fact that he had claimed retaliation, that by the attorney for the CTA, not this attorney, nor Mr. Thomas, Mr. Dean files too many complaints and lawsuits, and that he had saw on a screen, a monitor, information indicating that he was not to get insurance coverage because of his complaints. Now, those are credibility issues, and much of the argument devoted to this case by the defendant is that we gave him coverage. We gave him coverage. And indeed, retroactively in April of the year, rather than January when he was supposed to get it, he did get it. But his wife was not allowed to take certain therapy and have certain procedures. He was not allowed to have certain therapy and procedures because he didn't have insurance coverage for that period of time. The question then becomes for a fact finder to determine, well, did he not get this coverage because CTA was just too busy and botched it for some non-discriminatory reason, or did he not get this coverage because of discriminatory reasons? Those are determinations to be made by the fact finder. Those are credibility issues. Those are evidence weighing issues. Those are issues that are not to be determined by pieces of paper and not to be determined without some indication of the demeanor of the witnesses and things that we judge credibility by. So even looking at the submission, the 56 statement by the defendant, summary judgment was simply not appropriate here. The direct evidence that was presented in and of itself is sufficient to raise material issues of fact that should have been determined by a fact finder. And even if you look at it as being a circumstantial evidence case, the question of indirect evidence. The indirect evidence is that derogatory comments were being made concerning my client's age, concerning my client's complaints that he was making. And as a result of that, the summary judgment was simply not appropriate. So summary judgment was not appropriate for two reasons. One is we should have at least been allowed to present our response and then have it weighed. The judge specifically disallowed that response. I would echo to a certain extent something repeated earlier, which is that if the judge has a beef with me because I'm late, then fine. If he wants to sanction me, that's fine. That's obviously for him to do. But to say that filing a response to a summary judgment motion 20 days after the motion was filed bars my client from presenting his defense is too drastic to my client, who obviously had nothing to do with this. So under the circumstances, he should have permitted to have his day in court, and he wasn't permitted to do so. For all these reasons, Judge, we feel that the decision of the judge below should be reversed. It should be remanded. We should have an opportunity to present our side of the story and then have a ruling made on the summary judgment motion. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Andre. Mr. Wood, please.
May it please the court. This case involves two issues. The first is procedural. The second is the merits of plaintiff's underlying discrimination claims. With respect to the procedural issue, the issue really is not the fairness or unfairness of what the district court did, but rather whether the district court properly exercised its discretion to enter the order that it did, denying plaintiffs instanter and admittedly overdue motion. The second issue, then, is whether there's any merit to the underlying claims. And we believe that the district court properly exercised its discretion, in denying that motion. But secondly, and more importantly, that in any event, there is no merit to plaintiffs' age and disability discrimination claims below. If I could first address the procedural matter. The timeline for the filing of the motion for summary judgment in this case is as follows. The CTA, pursuant to the district court's schedule, filed its motion for summary judgment on the 23rd of January, which was a Friday. Subsequent to filing that motion, there was a realization at the office that some things were missed, some things were mistyped, and Monday morning we filed a motion for leave to file instanter a corrected summary judgment brief and papers.
Was that a different substantively from the first filing?
It was not different substantively at all. It really was a matter of typos. 1 year was wrong. There was an incorrect citation to an affidavit. But in order to correct that, we filed the motion for leave to file instanter. It was filed on Monday, noticed up for Thursday of that week. At that hearing, plaintiff's counsel did not appear. That would obviously have been the most opportune time for plaintiff to ask for additional time if he felt that any was necessary. Given that there was no substantive change in our positions, it probably wasn't necessary, but that would have been the opportunity to do so. The district court noted in the order that plaintiff's counsel did not appear. There was no request for additional time or an enlargement of that due date. So the due date of February 6th, 14 days after the CTA's initial motion was filed, continued on the books as the due date for plaintiff's response. February 6th came and went. There was no motion for an extension of time. There was no response filed by plaintiff's counsel. And nothing really happened in the case for two more weeks. 13 days after the initial due date, plaintiff's counsel filed a motion for leave to file the response in stanter. And in the motion, the only excuse plaintiff's counsel offered for failing to meet the initial deadline was his busy trial schedule. There are numerous cases in this circuit in which an attorney's busy schedule is given little or no weight when it comes to missing deadlines. And with respect to a deadline in the district court, it's hard to think of one that would be more crucial not to miss than responding to a dispositive motion on the merits, such as a response to a motion for summary judgment. The district court denied plaintiff's motion, noting that plaintiff's counsel had missed three prior hearings. I didn't practice in the district court for 30 years, but I will say that the first hearing before the new judge, Judge Dryagin, after this case was transferred from Judge Pallmeyer to Judge Dryagin, plaintiff's counsel didn't show. Plaintiff's counsel did not appear at that hearing to introduce himself, to kick off the relationship with the district court judge, and then subsequent to that missed two other hearings without explanation, without telling plaintiff's CTA's counsel, you can represent that I'm too busy to be there and that I don't object. There's nothing in the record to show that these missed hearings were part of the quote-unquote protocol of what happens in the district court. The district court denied the motion for leave to file instanter and deemed the CTA's facts admitted. Now, we noted in our opening brief the essential harmless error nature, to the extent that there was an error in the exercise of that discretion, the harmless error nature of that decision. Plaintiff's counsel's brief, a plaintiff's counsel attached the proposed brief, the proposed response to the statement of facts, to the motion. Those documents are in the record. Given that this court reviews de novo the summary judgment decision by the district court, this court does not need to remand to the district court again for a decision about whether there were sufficient genuine issues of material fact in the record on the summary judgment motion. This court can review that because its review is de novo. And to the extent that there is concern about what the district court judge did with respect to the motion for leave to file instanter, this court can decide whether the papers filed by plaintiff below that are currently in the record are sufficient to create a genuine issue of material fact. We, of course, believe that they do.
How about these statements concerning whether... Well, we don't need any old fellows like you around. Well, why doesn't that raise some kind of an issue?
Your Honor, that statement in the record, as well as the...
Too many complaints and lawsuits statement.
Complaints and lawsuits, the document that appeared but on the computer screen, but there's no physical record of, those statements do not support... the continuation of plaintiff's case, because either under the direct evidence approach or the indirect shifting approach, they do not connect to any adverse employment action that was visited upon this employee. There simply is no adverse employment action. The cases in the circuit define the adverse employment action as a material change in somebody's benefits and somebody's responsibilities and somebody's wages. That simply didn't happen
here. There's a suggestion here that he was forced to retire.
Again, plaintiff has never connected that forcing me to retire allegation to any change in material benefits or salary.
Didn't he fill out the form to retire?
I beg your pardon?
Did he fill out the form to retire?
He did, and he admits that he did. What he alleges in his response brief is that he filled it out in blank. In other words, he signed it, filled out all his sections of it, and that somehow then the CTA filled in other sections that he wasn't aware of. Notwithstanding that, he testified at his deposition that he talked to his attorney that day.
No matter what he filled out, though, if he had been forced into a situation where he had to retire, and I should not have been forced into that situation, wouldn't that be an adverse employment action?
If it was connected to some material change, at the time that he retired, he was in what was called Area 605. Mm-hmm. He was not receiving a salary. There's never been an allegation in any document in this record suggesting that his retirement changed any material benefit or job responsibility, or duty. He was essentially on ice. He was in Area 65 because he needed to maintain his benefits. Under the collective bargaining agreement, that's a temporary provision that can last 2 years, possibly 3 years. But at the end of that 3 years,
what gets you in there in the first place?
A disability. There are a number of different ways to get into Area 65, but primarily it's because you can't do your job duties.
Yeah, in this case, why do you?
It was he alleged that he had been disabled. He had two workers' compensation claims pending. He had some physical issues. Of course, these were all disputed below between the CTA and the employee. We denied that he was disabled, but notwithstanding that, during this interim period, he was on disability in Area 605. But there's never been an allegation to connect up even that claim, I was forced to retire, with any material change in his benefits. In addition to the lack of employment action, there also was never, in this case, an identification of a comparable employee who was treated more favorably based on age or based on disability. It simply does not exist. It wasn't in the response brief. It wasn't in the 56-1 statement. There simply is a lack in this record of any such evidence. So, in short, there were no genuine issues of material fact with respect to either of the discrimination claims. With respect to the retaliation claim, in addition to the fact that there, again, were no genuine issues of material fact because of the lack of an adverse job action and the lack of a comparable employee, in this case, in addition, there was a waiver by plaintiff by failing to include any allegations of retaliation in his EEOC charge. It wasn't simply a matter of not checking the box. Going down to the facts that are alleged in the EEOC charge, there are no facts to show that this gentleman was treated differently or was punished or retaliated against because of any protected activity at all. If there are no further questions, in closing, we ask that this court affirm the decision of the district court entering summary judgment for the CTA. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wood. You have 2 minutes, Mr. Andre.
First of all, I don't have a problem with the notion that if this court feels it's not necessary to remand, that they can look at the documents and make a decision, that you do so. So to that extent, I don't disagree with my brother over here on that. Also, with regard to comparable employees, and essentially what counsel is referring to is the McDonnell-Douglas framework of proof, that doesn't apply to a direct evidence case. If you're telling someone that you're discriminating against them because of their status, their age, their disability, or whatever the case may be, or because of their engaging in protected activity, you don't have to prove that there's a comparable employee somewhere that they treated differently than that. You've already defined what the situation is, and you've already defined what your motivation is. So it's not necessary to go through a McDonnell-Douglas analysis on a direct evidence case, and that's what this is. Counsel also talks about the fact that there was no adverse action here. My clients were denied their insurance benefits. which was absolutely necessary for their treatment, him because of an injury and his wife because of chronic ailments that she had. And they were denied treatment because they didn't have those benefits. And that's been pointed out. So there's clearly adverse actions in the denial of those benefits, if nothing else. For all of those reasons, we feel that either a reversal and remand is necessary, or, again, I have no problem with this court, if it feels that it's appropriate, looking at the documentation and making a determination as to whether summary judgment was appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andry. My thanks to Mr. Andry and to Mr. Wood. And the case will be taken under advisement.